Chapter 10. I fear we shall outsleep the coming morn as much as we this night have overwatched. Midsummer Night's Dream. The instant the shock of this sudden misfortune had abated, Duncan began to make his observations on the appearance and proceedings of their captors. Contrary to the usages of the natives in the wantonness of their success, they had respected not only the persons of the trembling sisters, but his own. The rich ornaments of his military attire had indeed been repeatedly handled by different individuals of the tribe, with eyes expressing a savage longing to possess the baubles. But before the customary violence could be resorted to, a mandate, in the authoritative voice of the large warrior already mentioned, stayed the uplifted hand, and convinced Hayward that they were to be reserved for some object of particular moment. While, however, these manifestations of weakness were exhibited by the young and vain of the party, the more experienced warriors continued their search throughout both caverns with an activity that denoted they were far from being satisfied with those fruits of their conquest which had already been brought to light. Unable to discover any new victim, these diligent workers of vengeance soon approached their male prisoners, pronouncing the name of Lalonde Carabine with a fierceness that could not easily be mistaken. Duncan affected not to comprehend the meaning of their repeated and violent interrogatories, while his companion was spared the effort of a similar deception by his ignorance of French. Wearied at length by their importunities, and apprehensive of irritating his captors by too stubborn a silence, the former looked about him in quest of Magua, who might interpret his answers to questions which were at each moment becoming more earnest and threatening. The conduct of this savage had formed a solitary exception to that of all his fellows. While the others were busily occupied in seeking to gratify their childish passion for finery by plundering even the miserable effects of the scout, or had been searching, with such bloodthirsty vengeance in their looks, for their absent owner, Le Renard had stood at a little distance from the prisoners, with a demeanor so quiet and satisfied as to betray that he had already effected the grand purpose of this treachery. When the eyes of Hayward first met those of his recent guide, he turned them away in horror at the sinister, though calm, look he encountered. Conquering his disgust, however, he was able, with an averted face, to address his successful enemy. "Le Renard Subtil is too much of a warrior," said the reluctant Hayward, "to refuse telling an unarmed man what his conquerors say. They ask for the hunter, who knows the paths through the woods," returned Magua in his broken English, laying his hand at the same time with a ferocious smile on the bundle of leaves with which a wound on his own shoulder was bandaged. "Lalonde Carabine, his rifle is good, and his eye never shut. But, like the short gun of the white chief, it is nothing against the life of Le Subtil." "Le Renard is too brave to remember the hurts received in war, or the hands that gave them. Was it war, when the tired Indian rested at the sugar tree to taste his corn? Who filled the bushes with creeping enemies? Who drew the knife? Whose tongue was peace, while his heart was colored with blood? Did Magua say that the hatchet was out of the ground, and that his hand had dug it up?" As Duncan dared not retort upon his accuser by reminding him of his own premeditated treachery, and disdained to deprecate his resentment by any words of apology, he remained silent. Magua seemed also content to rest the controversy as well as all further communication there, for he resumed the leaning attitude against the rock, from which in momentary energy he had arisen. But the cry of Lalonde Carabine was renewed the instant the impatient savages perceived that the short dialogue was ended. "You hear," said Magua with stubborn indifference. "The Red Hurons call for the life of the Long Rifle, or they will have the blood of them that keep him hid." "He is gone, escaped. He is far beyond their reach." Renard smiled with cold contempt as he answered, "When the white man dies, he thinks he is at peace, but the red men know how to torture even the ghosts of their enemies. Where is his body? Let the Hurons see his scalp." "He is not dead, but escaped." Magua shook his head incredulously. "Is he a bird to spread his wings? Or is he a fish to swim without air? The white chief reads in his books, and he believes the Hurons are fools." "Though no fish, the Long Rifle can swim. He floated down the stream when the powder was all burnt, and when the eyes of the Hurons were behind a cloud. "And why did the White Chief stay?" demanded the still incredulous Indian. "Is he a stone that goes to the bottom, or does the scalp burn his head?" "That I am not a stone, your dead comrade who fell into the falls might answer, were the life still in him," said the provoked young man, using in his anger that boastful language which was most likely to excite the admiration of an Indian. "The white man thinks none but cowards desert their women." Magua muttered a few words inaudibly between his teeth before he continued aloud, "Can the Delawares swim too, as well as crawl in the bushes? Where is Le Gros Serpent?" Duncan, who perceived by the use of these Canadian appellations that his late companions were much better known to his enemies than to himself, answered reluctantly, "He also is gone down with the water." "Le Cerf Agile is not here?"
"I know not whom you call the nimble deer," said Duncan, gladly profiting by any excuse to create delay.
"Uncas," returned Magua, pronouncing the Delaware name with even greater difficulty than he spoke his English words. "Bounding elk is what the white man says when he calls to the young Mohican."
"Here is some confusion in names between us, Le Renard," said Duncan, hoping to provoke a discussion. "Dam is the French for deer, and cerf for stag. Elan is the true term when one would speak of an elk."
"Yes," muttered the Indian in his native tongue. "The pale faces are prattling women. They have two words for each thing, while a redskin will make the sound of his voice speak for him."
Then changing his language, he continued, adhering to the imperfect nomenclature of his provincial instructors,
"The deer is swift but weak. The elk is swift but strong. The son of Le Serpent is Le Cerf Agile. Has he leapt the river to the woods?"
"If you mean the younger Delaware, he too is gone down with the water."
As there was nothing improbable to an Indian in the manner of the escape, Magua admitted the truth of what he had heard with a readiness that afforded additional evidence how little he would prize such worthless captives. With his companions, however, the feeling was manifestly different. The Hurons had awaited the result of this short dialogue with characteristic patience, and with a silence that increased until there was a general stillness in the band. When Hayward ceased to speak, they turned their eyes as one man on Magua, demanding, in this expressive manner, an explanation of what had been said. Their interpreter pointed to the river, and made them acquainted with the result as much by the action as by the few words he uttered. When the fact was generally understood, the savages raised a frightful yell, which declared the extent of their disappointment. Some ran furiously to the water's edge, beating the air with frantic gestures, while others spat upon the element to resent the supposed treason it had committed against their acknowledged rights as conquerors. A few, and they not the least powerful and terrific of the band, threw lowering looks, in which the fiercest passion was only tempered by habitual self-command, at those captives who still remained in their power, while one or two even gave vent to their malignant feelings by the most menacing gestures, against which neither the sex nor the beauty of the sisters was any protection. The young soldier made a desperate but fruitless effort to spring to the side of Alice when he saw the dark hand of a savage twisted in the rich tresses which were flowing in volumes over her shoulders, while a knife was passed around the head from which they fell, as if to denote the horrid manner in which it was about to be robbed of its beautiful ornament. But his hands were bound, and at the first movement he made he felt the grasp of the powerful Indian who directed the band pressing his shoulder like a vice. Immediately conscious how unavailing any struggle against such an overwhelming force must prove, he submitted to his fate, encouraging his gentle companions by a few low and tender assurances that the natives seldom failed to threaten more than they performed. But while Duncan resorted to these words of consolation to quiet the apprehensions of the sisters, he was not so weak as to deceive himself. He well knew that the authority of an Indian chief was so little conventional that it was oftener maintained by physical superiority than by any moral supremacy he might possess. The danger was therefore magnified exactly in proportion to the number of the savage spirits by which they were surrounded. The most positive mandate from him who seemed the acknowledged leader was liable to be violated at each moment by any rash hand that might choose to sacrifice a victim to the manes of some dead friend or relative.
While, therefore, he sustained an outward appearance of calmness and fortitude, his heart leaped into his throat whenever any of their fierce captors drew nearer than common to the helpless sisters, or fastened one of their sullen, wandering looks on those fragile forms which were so little able to resist the slightest assault. His apprehensions were, however, greatly relieved when he saw that the leader had summoned his warriors to himself in council. Their deliberations were short, and it would seem by the silence of most of the party the decision unanimous. By the frequency with which the few speakers pointed in the direction of the encampment of Webb, it was apparent they dreaded the approach of danger from that quarter. This consideration probably hastened their determination and quickened the subsequent movements. During this short conference, Hayward, finding a respite from his greatest fears, had leisure to admire the cautious manner in which the Hurons had made their approaches, even after hostilities had ceased. It has already been stated that the upper half of the island was a naked rock, and destitute of any other defenses than a few scattered logs of driftwood. They had selected this point to make their descent, having borne the canoe through the wood around the cataract for that purpose. Placing their arms in the little vessel, a dozen men clinging to its sides had trusted themselves to the direction of the canoe, which was controlled by two of the most skillful warriors, in attitudes that enabled them to command a view of the dangerous passage. Favored by this arrangement, they touched the head of the island at that point which had proved so fatal to their first adventures, but with the advantages of superior numbers and the possession of firearms. That such had been the manner of their descent was rendered quite apparent to Duncan, for they now bore the light bark from the upper end of the rock and placed it in the water near the mouth of the outer cavern. As soon as this change was made, the leader made signs to the prisoners to descend and enter. As resistance was impossible and remonstrance useless, Hayward set the example of submission by leading the way into the canoe, where he was soon seated with the sisters and the still wondering David. Notwithstanding the Hurons were necessarily ignorant of the little channels among the eddies and rapids of the stream, they knew the common signs of such a navigation too well to commit any material blunder. When the pilot chosen for the task of guiding the canoe had taken his station, the whole band plunged again into the river, the vessel glided down the current, and in a few moments the captives found themselves on the south bank of the stream, nearly opposite to the point where they had struck it the preceding evening. Here was held another short but earnest consultation, during which the horses, to whose panic their owners ascribed their heaviest misfortune, were led from the cover of the woods and brought to the sheltered spot. The band now divided. The great chief, so often mentioned, mounting the charger of Hayward, led the way directly across the river, followed by most of his people, and disappeared in the woods, leaving the prisoners in charge of six savages, at whose head was Le Renard Sutil. Duncan witnessed all their movements with renewed uneasiness. He had been fond of believing, from the uncommon forbearance of the savages, that he was reserved as a prisoner to be delivered to Montcalm. As the thoughts of those who are in misery seldom slumber, and the invention is never more lively than when it is stimulated by hope, however feeble and remote, he had even imagined that the parental feelings of Monroe were to be made instrumental in seducing him from his duty to the king. For though the French commander bore a high character for courage and enterprise, he was also thought to be expert in those political practices which do not always respect the nicer obligations of morality, and which so generally disgrace the European diplomacy of that period. All those busy and ingenious speculations were now annihilated by the conduct of his captors. That portion of the band who had followed the huge warrior took the route towards the foot of the Horican, and no other expectation was left for himself and companions than that they were to be retained as hopeless captives by their savage conquerors. Anxious to know the worst, and willing, in such an emergency, to try the potency of gold, he overcame his reluctance to speak to Magua. Addressing himself to his former guide, who had now assumed the authority and manner of one who was to direct the future movements of the party, he said, in tones as friendly and confiding as he could assume, "I would speak to Magua what is fit only for so great a chief to hear." The Indian turned his eyes on the young soldier scornfully as he answered, "Speak. Trees have no ears, but the Red Hurons are not deaf, and counsel that is fit for the great men of a nation would make the young warriors drunk. If Magua will not listen, the officer of the king knows how to be silent. The savage spoke carelessly to his comrades who were busied, after their awkward manner, in preparing the horses for the reception of the sisters, and moved a little to one side, whither by a cautious gesture he induced Hayward to follow. "Now speak," he said, "if the words are such as Magua should hear."
"Le Renard Sutil has proved himself worthy of the honorable name given to him by his Canada fathers," commenced Hayward. "I see his wisdom, and all that he has done for us, and shall remember it when the hour to reward him arrives. Yes, Renard has proved that he is not only a great chief in council, but one who knows how to deceive his enemies."
"What has Renard done?" coldly demanded the Indian.
"What?
Has he not seen that the woods were filled with outlying parties of the enemies, and that the serpent could not steal through them without being seen? Then did he not lose his path to blind the eyes of the Hurons? Did he not pretend to go back to his tribe, who had treated him ill and driven him from their wigwams like a dog? And when we saw what he wished to do, did we not aid him by making a false face, that the Hurons might think the white man believed that his friend was his enemy? Is not all this true? And when Le Sutil had shut the eyes and stopped the ears of his nation by his wisdom, did they not forget that they had once done him wrong and forced him to flee to the Mohawks? And did they not leave him on the south side of the river with their prisoners, while they have gone foolishly on the north? Does not Renard mean to turn like a fox on his footsteps and to carry to the rich and gray-headed Scotchman his daughters?
Yes, Magua, I see it all. And I have already been thinking how so much wisdom and honesty should be repaid. First, the chief of William Henry will give as a great chief should for such a service. The medal of Magua will no longer be of tin, but of beaten gold. His horn will run over with powder. Dollars will be as plenty in his pouch as pebbles on the shore of Horican, and the deer will lick his hand, for they will know it to be vain to fly from the rifle he will carry. As for myself, I know not how to exceed the gratitude of the Scotchman, but I will...
What will the young chief who comes from towards the sun give? Demanded the Huron, observing that Hayward hesitated in his desire to end the enumeration of benefits with that which might form the climax of an Indian's wishes.
He will make the fire water from the islands in the Salt Lake flow before the wigwam of Magua, until the heart of the Indian shall be lighter than the feathers of the hummingbird, and his breath sweeter than the wild honeysuckle.
Le Renard had listened gravely as Hayward slowly proceeded in his subtle speech. When the young man mentioned the artifice he supposed the Indian to have practiced on his own nation, the countenance of the listener was veiled in an expression of cautious gravity. At the allusion to the injury which Duncan affected to believe had driven the Huron from his native tribe, a gleam of such ungovernable ferocity flashed from the other's eyes as induced the adventurous speaker to believe he had struck the proper chord. And by the time he reached the part where he so artfully blended the thirst of vengeance with the desire of gain, he had at least obtained a command of the deepest attention of the savage. The question put by Le Renard had been calm, and with all the dignity of an Indian, but it was quite apparent, by the thoughtful expression of the listener's countenance, that the answer was most cunningly devised. The Huron mused a few moments, and then, laying his hand on the rude bandages of his wounded shoulder, he said with some energy, "Do friends make such remarks? Would Lalonde Carabine cut one so light on an enemy? Do the Delawares crawl upon those they love like snakes, twisting themselves to strike? Would Le Gros Serpent have been heard by the ears of one he wished to be deaf? Does the white chief burn his powder in the faces of his brothers? Does he ever miss his aim, when seriously bent to kill?" returned Duncan, smiling with well-acted sincerity. Another long and deliberate pause succeeded these sententious questions and ready replies. Duncan saw that the Indian hesitated. In order to complete his victory, he was in the act of recommencing the enumeration of the rewards, when Magua made an expressive gesture and said, "Enough. Le Renard is a wise chief, and what he does will be seen. Go and keep the mouth shut. When Magua speaks, it will be time to answer." Hayward, perceiving that the eyes of his companion were warily fastened on the rest of the band, fell back immediately, in order to avoid the appearance of any suspicious confederacy with their leader. Magua approached the horses, and affected to be well pleased with the diligence and ingenuity of his comrades. He then signed to Hayward to assist the sisters into the saddles, for he seldom deigned to use the English tongue unless urged by some motive of more than usual moment. There was no longer any plausible pretext for delay, and Duncan was obliged, however reluctantly, to comply. As he performed this office, he whispered his reviving hopes in the ears of the trembling females, who, through dread of encountering the savage countenances of their captors, seldom raised their eyes from the ground. The mare of David had been taken with the followers of the large chief. In consequence, its owner, as well as Duncan, was compelled to journey on foot. The latter did not, however, so much regret this circumstance as it might enable him to retard the speed of the party, for he still turned his longing looks in the direction of Fort Edward, in the vain expectation of catching some sound from that quarter of the forest which might denote the approach of succor. When all were prepared, Magua made the signal to proceed, advancing in front to lead the party in person. Next followed David, who was gradually coming to a true sense of his condition as the effects of the wound became less and less apparent. The sisters rode in his rear, with Hayward at their side, while the Indians flanked the party and brought up the close of the march with a caution that seemed never to tire. In this manner they proceeded in uninterrupted silence, except when Hayward addressed some solitary word of comfort to the females, or David gave vent to the moanings of his spirit in piteous exclamations, which he intended should express the humility of resignation. Their direction lay towards the south, and in a course nearly opposite to the road to William Henry. Notwithstanding this apparent adherence in Magua to the original determination of his conquerors, Hayward could not believe his tempting bait was so soon forgotten, and he knew the windings of an Indian path too well to suppose that its apparent course led directly to its object when artifice was at all necessary. Mile after mile was, however, passed through the boundless woods in this painful manner without any prospect of a termination to their journey. Hayward watched the sun as he darted his meridian rays through the branches of the trees, and pined for the moment when the policy of Magua should change their route to one more favorable to his hopes. Sometimes he fancied the wary savage, despairing of passing the arm of Montcalm in safety, was holding his way towards a well-known border settlement, where a distinguished officer of the crown and a favorite friend of the Six Nations held his large possessions as well as his usual residence. To be delivered into the hands of Sir William Johnson was far preferable to being led into the wilds of Canada. But in order to effect even the former, it would be necessary to traverse the forest for many weary leagues, each step of which was carrying him farther from the scene of the war, and consequently from the post not only of honor, but of duty. Cora alone remembered the parting injunctions of the scout, and whenever an opportunity offered, she stretched forth her arm to bend aside the twigs that met her hands. But the vigilance of the Indians rendered this act of precaution both difficult and dangerous. She was often defeated in her purpose by encountering their watchful eyes when it became necessary to feign an alarm she did not feel, and occupy the limb by some gesture of feminine apprehension. Once, and only once, was she completely successful, when she broke down the bough of a large sumac, and by a sudden thought let her glove fall at the same instant. This sign, intended for those that might follow, was observed by one of her conductors who restored the glove, broke the remaining branches of the bush in such a manner that it appeared to proceed from the struggling of some beast in its branches, and then laid his hand on his tomahawk with a look so significant that it put an effectual end to these stolen memorials of their passage. As there were horses to leave the prints of their footsteps in both bands of the Indians, this interruption cut off any probable hopes of assistance being conveyed through the means of their trail. Hayward would have ventured a remonstrance had there been anything encouraging in the gloomy reserve of Magua, but the savage, during all this time, seldom turned to look at his followers, and never spoke. With the sun for his only guide, or aided by such blind marks as are only known to the sagacity of a native, he held his way along the barrens of pine, through occasional little fertile vales, across brooks and rivulets, and over undulating hills, with the accuracy of instinct, and nearly with the directness of a bird. He never seemed to hesitate. Whether the path was hardly distinguishable, whether it disappeared, or whether it lay beaten and plain before him, made no sensible difference in his speed or certainty. It seemed as if fatigue could not affect him. Whenever the eyes of the wearied travelers rose from the decayed leaves over which they trod, his dark form was to be seen glancing among the stems of the trees in front, his head immovably fastened in a forward position, with a light plume on his crest fluttering in a current of air made solely by the swiftness of his own motion. But all this diligence and speed were not without an object. After crossing a low vale, through which a gushing brook meandered, he suddenly ascended a hill so steep and difficult of ascent that the sisters were compelled to alight in order to follow. When the summit was gained, they found themselves on a level spot, but thinly covered with trees, under one of which Magua had thrown his dark form, as if willing and ready to seek that rest which was so much needed by the whole party. Chapter 11. Cursed by my tribe, if I forgive him. Shylock. The Indian had selected, for this desirable purpose, one of those steep, pyramidal hills which bear a strong resemblance to artificial mounds, and which so frequently occur in the valleys of America. The one in question was high and precipitous, its top flattened as usual, but with one of its sides more than ordinarily irregular. It possessed no other apparent advantage for a resting place than in its elevation and form, which might render defense easy and surprise nearly impossible. As Hayward, however, no longer expected that rescue which time and distance now rendered so improbable, he regarded these little peculiarities with an eye devoid of interest, devoting himself entirely to the comfort and condolence of his feebler companions. The Narragansetts were suffered to browse on the branches of the trees and shrubs that were thinly scattered over the summit of the hill, while the remains of their provisions were spread under the shade of a beech that stretched its horizontal limbs like a canopy above them. Notwithstanding the swiftness of their flight, one of the Indians had found an opportunity to strike a straggling fawn with an arrow, and had borne the more preferable fragments of the victim patiently on his shoulders to the stopping place. Without any aid from the science of cookery, he was immediately employed, in common with his fellows, in gorging himself with this digestible sustenance. Magua alone sat apart, without participation in the revolting meal, and apparently buried in the deepest thought. This abstinence, so remarkable in an Indian, when he possessed the means of satisfying hunger, at length attracted the notice of Hayward. The young man willingly believed that the Huron deliberated on the most eligible manner of eluding the vigilance of his associates, with a view to assist his plans by any suggestion of his own, and to strengthen the temptation. He left the beach and straggled as if without an object to the spot where Le Renard was seated. "Has not Magua kept the sun in his face long enough to escape all danger from the Canadians?" he asked, as though no longer doubtful of the good intelligence established between them. "And will not the chief of William Henry be better pleased to see his daughters before another night may have hardened his heart to their loss, to make him less liberal in his reward? Do the pale faces love their children less in the morning than at night?" asked the Indian coldly. "By no means," returned Hayward, anxious to recall his error, if he had made one. "The white man may, and does often, forget the burial place of his fathers. He sometimes ceases to remember those he should love and has promised to cherish. But the affection of a parent for his child is never permitted to die." "And is the heart of the white-headed chief soft? And will he think of the babes that his squaws have given him? He is hard to his warriors, and his eyes are made of stone. He is severe to the idle and wicked, but to the sober and deserving he is a leader, but just and humane. I have known many fond and tender parents, but never have I seen a man whose heart was softer towards his child. You have seen the gray head in front of his warriors, Magua, but I have seen his eyes swimming in water when he spoke of those children who are now in your power." Hayward paused, for he knew not how to construe the remarkable expression that gleamed across the swarthy features of the attentive Indian. At first it seemed as if the remembrance of the promised reward grew vivid in his mind while he listened to the sources of parental feeling which were to assure its possession. But as Duncan proceeded, the expression of joy became so fiercely malignant that it was impossible not to apprehend it proceeded from some passion more sinister than avarice. "Go," said the Huron, suppressing the alarming exhibition in an instant, in a death-like calmness of countenance. "Go to the dark-haired daughter and say Magua waits to speak. The father will remember what the child promises."
Duncan, who interpreted this speech to express a wish for some additional pledge that the promised gifts should not be withheld, slowly and reluctantly repaired to the place where the sisters were now resting from their fatigue to communicate its purport to Cora.
"You understand the nature of an Indian's wishes," he concluded, as he led her towards the place where she was expected, "and must be prodigal of your offers of powder and blankets. Ardent spirits are, however, the most prized by such as he, nor would it be amiss to add some boon from your own hand, with that grace you so well know how to practice. Remember, Cora, that on your presence of mind and ingenuity, even your life, as well as that of Alice, may in some measure depend."
"Heyward, and yours?"
"Mine is of little moment. It is already sold to my king, and is a prize to be seized by any enemy who may possess the power. I have no father to expect me, and but few friends to lament a fate which I have courted with the insatiable longings of youth after distinction. But hush, we approach the Indian. Magua, the lady with whom you wish to speak, is here." The Indian rose slowly from his seat and stood for near a minute, silent and motionless. He then signed with his hand for Heyward to retire, saying coldly, "When the Huron talks to the women, his tribe shut their ears." Duncan, still lingering as if refusing to comply, Cora said, with a calm smile,
"You hear, Heyward, and delicacy at least should urge you to retire. Go to Alice and comfort her with our reviving prospects."
She waited until he had departed, and then turning to the native, with the dignity of her sex in her voice and manner, she added,
"What would Lurinat say to the daughter of Monroe?"
"Listen," said the Indian, laying his hand firmly upon her arm as if willing to draw her utmost attention to his words, a movement that Cora as firmly but quietly repulsed by extricating the limb from his grasp. "Magua was born a chief and a warrior among the red Hurons of the lakes. He saw the suns of 20 summers make the snows of 20 winters run off in the streams before he saw a paleface, and he was happy. Then his Canada fathers came into the woods and taught him to drink the fire water, and he became a rascal. The Hurons drove him from the graves of his fathers as they would chase the hunted buffalo. He ran down the shores of the lakes and followed their outlet to the city of Cannon. There he hunted and fished, till the people chased him again through the woods into the arms of his enemies. The chief, who was born a Huron, was at last a warrior among the Mohawks."
"Something like this I had heard before," said Cora, observing that he paused to suppress those passions which began to burn with too bright a flame as he recalled the recollection of his supposed injuries.
"Was it the fault of Lurinard that his head was not made of rock? Who gave him the fire water? Who made him a villain? 'Twas the pale faces, the people of your own color."
"And am I answerable that thoughtless and unprincipled men exist, whose shades of countenance may resemble mine?"
Cora calmly demanded of the excited savage.
"No. Magua is a man, and not a fool. Such as you never opened their lips to the burning stream. The Great Spirit has given you wisdom."
"What then have I to do or say in the matter of your misfortunes, not to say of your errors?"
"Listen," repeated the Indian, resuming his earnest attitude. "When his English and French fathers dug up the hatchet, Lurinard struck the war post of the Mohawks and went out against his own nation. The pale faces have driven the redskins from their hunting grounds, and now, when they fight, a white man leads the way. The old chief at Horican, your father, was the great captain of our war party. He said to the Mohawks, 'Do this and do that,' and he was minded. He made a law that if an Indian swallowed the fire water and came into the cloth wigwams of his warriors, it should not be forgotten. Magua foolishly opened his mouth, and the hot liquor led him into the cabin of Monroe. What did the gray head? Let his daughter say."
"He forgot not his words, and did justice by punishing the offender," said the undaunted daughter.
"Justice!" repeated the Indian, casting an oblique glance of the most ferocious expression at her unyielding countenance. "Is it justice to make evil and then punish for it? Magua was not himself. It was the fire water that spoke and acted for him. But Monroe did not believe it. The Huron chief was tied up before all the pale-faced warriors and whipped like a dog."
Cora remained silent, for she knew not how to palliate this imprudent severity on the part of her father in a manner to suit the comprehension of an Indian.
"See," continued Magua, tearing aside the slight calico that very imperfectly concealed his painted breast, "here are scars given by knives and bullets. Of these a warrior may boast before his nation. But the gray head has left marks on the back of the Huron chief that he must hide, like a squaw, under this painted cloth of the whites."
"I had thought," resumed Cora, "that an Indian warrior was patient, and that his spirit felt not and knew not the pain his body suffered."
"When the Chippewas tied Magua to the stake and cut this gash," said the other, laying his finger on a deep scar, "the Huron laughed in their faces and told them, 'Women struck so light.' His spirit was then in the clouds. But when he felt the blows of Monroe, his spirit lay under the birch. The spirit of a Huron is never drunk. It remembers forever."
"But it may be appeased. If my father has done you this injustice, show him how an Indian can forgive an injury, and take back his daughters. You have heard from Major Hayward."
Magua shook his head, forbidding the repetition of offers he so much despised.
"What would you have?" continued Cora, after a most painful pause, while the conviction forced itself on her mind that the too sanguine and generous Duncan had been cruelly deceived by the cunning of the savage.
"What a Huron loves! Good for good, bad for bad."
"You would then revenge the injury inflicted by Monroe on his helpless daughters? Would it not be more like a man to go before his face and take the satisfaction of a warrior?"
"The arms of the pale faces are long, and their knives sharp," returned the savage with a malignant laugh. "Why would Le Renard go among the muskets of his warriors when he holds the spirit of the gray head in his hand?"
"Name your intention, Magua," said Cora, struggling with herself to speak with steady calmness. "Is it to lead us prisoners to the woods, or do you contemplate even some greater evil? Is there no reward, no means of palliating the injury and of softening your heart? At least release my gentle sister, and pour out all your malice on me. Purchase wealth by her safety, and satisfy your revenge with a single victim. The loss of both of his daughters might bring the aged man to his grave, and where would then be the satisfaction of Le Renard?"
"Listen," said the Indian again. "The Light Eyes can go back to the Horican and tell the old chief what has been done, if the dark-haired woman will swear by the great spirit of her fathers to tell no lie."
"What must I promise?" demanded Cora, still maintaining a secret ascendancy over the fierce native by the collected and feminine dignity of her presence.
"When Magua left his people, his wife was given to another chief. He has now made friends with the Hurons and will go back to the graves of his tribe on the shores of the Great Lake. Let the daughter of the English chief follow, and live in his wigwam forever."
However revolting a proposal of such a character might prove to Cora, she retained, notwithstanding her powerful disgust, sufficient self-command to reply without betraying the weakness. "And what pleasure would Magua find in sharing his cabin with a wife he did not love? One who would be of a nation and color different from his own? It would be better to take the gold of Monroe and buy the heart of some Huron maid with his gifts." The Indian made no reply for near a minute, but bent his fierce looks on the countenance of Cora in such wavering glances that her eyes sank with shame, under an impression that for the first time they had encountered an expression that no chaste female might endure. While she was shrinking within herself, in dread of having her ears wounded by some proposal still more shocking than the last, the voice of Magua answered in its tones of deepest malignancy.
"When the blows scorched the back of the Huron, he would know where to find a woman to feel the smart. The daughter of Monroe would draw his water,
hoe his corn, and cook his venison. The body of the gray head would sleep among his cannon, but his heart would lie within reach of the knife of Le Subtil.
Monster! Well dost thou deserve thy treacherous name, cried Cora, in an ungovernable burst of filial indignation. None but a fiend could meditate such a vengeance, but thou overratest thy power. You shall find it is in truth the heart of Monroe you hold, and that it will defy your utmost malice.
The Indian answered this bold defiance by a ghastly smile that showed an unaltered purpose, while he motioned her away as if to close the conference forever. Cora, already regretting her precipitation, was obliged to comply, for Magua instantly left the spot and approached his gluttonous comrades. Hayward flew to the side of the agitated female and demanded the result of a dialogue that he had watched at a distance with so much interest. But unwilling to alarm the fears of Alice, she evaded a direct reply, betraying only by her countenance her utter want of success, and keeping her anxious looks fastened on the slightest movements of their captors. To the reiterated and earnest questions of her sister concerning their probable destination, she made no other answer than by pointing towards the dark group with an agitation she could not control and murmuring, as she folded Alice to her bosom,
"There, there, read our fortunes in their faces. We shall see, we shall see."
The action and the choked utterance of Cora spoke more impressively than any words, and quickly drew the attention of her companions on that spot where her own was riveted with an intenseness that nothing but the importance of the stake could create. When Magua reached the cluster of lolling savages, who, gorged with their disgusting meal, lay stretched on the earth in brutal indulgence, he commenced speaking with the dignity of an Indian chief. The first syllables he uttered had the effect to cause his listeners to raise themselves in attitudes of respectful attention. As the Huron used his native language, the prisoners, notwithstanding the caution of the natives had kept them within the swing of their tomahawks, could only conjecture the substance of his harangue from the nature of those significant gestures with which an Indian always illustrates his eloquence. At first, the language, as well as the action of Magua, appeared calm and deliberate. When he had succeeded in sufficiently awaking the attention of his comrades, Hayward fancied, by his pointing so frequently towards the direction of the Great Lakes, that he spoke of the land of their fathers and of their distant tribe. Frequent indications of applause escaped the listeners, who, as they uttered the expressive, "Huh!" looked at each other in commendation of the speaker. Le Renard was too skillful to neglect his advantage. He now spoke of the long and painful route by which they had left those spacious grounds and happy villages to come and battle against the enemies of their Canadian fathers. He enumerated the warriors of the party, their several merits, their frequent services to the nation, their wounds, and the number of the scalps they had taken. Whenever he alluded to any present, and the subtle Indian neglected none, the dark countenance of the flattered individual gleamed with exultation, nor did he even hesitate to assert the truth of the words by gestures of applause and confirmation. Then the voice of the speaker fell, and lost the loud, animated tones of triumph with which he had enumerated their deeds of success and victory. He described the cataract of glens, the impregnable position of its rocky island, with its caverns and its numerous rapids and whirlpools. He named the name of La Longue Carabine, and paused until the forest beneath them had sent up the last echo of a loud and long yell with which the hated appellation was received. He pointed towards the youthful military captive and described the death of a favorite warrior who had been precipitated into the deep ravine by his hand. He not only mentioned the fate of him who, hanging between heaven and earth, had presented such a spectacle of horror to the whole band, but he acted anew the terrors of his situation, his resolution, and his death on the branches of a sapling. And finally, he rapidly recounted the manner in which each of their friends had fallen, never failing to touch upon their courage and their most acknowledged virtues. When this recital of events was ended, his voice once more changed and became plaintive, and even musical in its low guttural sounds. He now spoke of the wives and children of the slain, their destitution, their misery, both physical and moral, their distance, and at last of their unavenged wrongs. Then, suddenly lifting his voice to a pitch of terrific energy, he concluded by demanding, "Are the Hurons dogs to bear this? Who shall say to the wife of Managua that the fishes have his scalp, and that his nation have not taken revenge? Who will dare meet the mother of Wassawatomie, that scornful woman, with his hands clean? What shall be said to the old men when they ask us for scalps, and we have not a hair from our white head to give them? The women will point their fingers at us. There is a dark spot on the names of the Hurons, and it must be hid in blood."
His voice was no longer audible in the burst of rage which now broke into the air, as if the wood, instead of containing so small a band, was filled with the nation. During the foregoing address, the progress of the speaker was too plainly read by those most interested in his success through the medium of the countenances of the men he addressed. They had answered his melancholy and mourning by sympathy and sorrow, his assertions by gestures of confirmation, and his boastings with the exultation of savages. When he spoke of courage, their looks were firm and responsive. When he alluded to their injuries, their eyes kindled with fury. When he mentioned the taunts of the women, they dropped their heads in shame. But when he pointed out their means of vengeance, he struck a chord which never failed to thrill in the breast of an Indian. With the first intimation that it was within their reach, the whole band sprang upon their feet as one man. Giving utterance to their rage in the most frantic cries, they rushed upon their prisoners in a body with drawn knives and uplifted tomahawks. Hayward threw himself between the sisters and the foremost, whom he grappled with a desperate strength that for a moment checked his violence. This unexpected resistance gave Magua time to interpose, and with rapid enunciation and animated gesture, he drew the attention of the band again to himself. In that language he knew so well how to assume, he diverted his comrades from their instant purpose, and invited them to prolong the misery of their victims. His proposal was received with acclamations, and executed with the swiftness of thought. Two powerful warriors cast themselves on Hayward, while another was occupied in securing the less active singing master. Neither of the captives, however, submitted without a desperate, though fruitless, struggle. Even David hurled his assailant to the earth, nor was Hayward secured until the victory over his companion enabled the Indians to direct their united force to that object. He was then bound and fastened to the body of the sapling, on whose branches Magua had acted the pantomime of the falling Huron. When the young soldier regained his recollection, he had the painful certainty before his eyes that a common fate was intended for the whole party. On his right was Cora, in endurance similar to his own, pale and agitated, but with an eye whose steady look still read the proceedings of their enemies. On his left, the withes which bound her to a pine performed that office for Alice which her trembling limbs refused, and alone kept her fragile form from sinking. Her hands were clasped before her in prayer, but instead of looking upwards towards that power which alone could rescue them, her unconscious looks wandered to the countenance of Duncan with infantile dependency. David had contended, and the novelty of the circumstance held him silent, in deliberation on the propriety of the unusual occurrence. The vengeance of the Hurons had now taken a new direction, and they prepared to execute it with that barbarous ingenuity with which they were familiarized by the practice of centuries. Some sought knots to raise the blazing pile. One was riving the splinters of pine in order to pierce the flesh of their captives with the burning fragments, and others bent the tops of two saplings to the earth in order to suspend Hayward by the arms between the recoiling branches. But the vengeance of Magua sought a deeper and more malignant enjoyment. While the less refined monsters of the band prepared, before the eyes of those who were to suffer, these well-known and vulgar means of torture, he approached Cora, and pointed out, with the most malign expression of countenance, the speedy fate that awaited her.
"Ha!" he added. "What says the daughter of Monroe? Her head is too good to find a pillow in the wigwam of Le Renard. Will she like it better when it rolls about this hill a plaything for the wolves? Her bosom cannot nurse the children of a Huron. She will see it spit upon by Indians."
"What means the monster?" demanded the astonished Hayward. "Nothing," was the firm reply. "He is a savage, a barbarous and ignorant savage, and knows not what he does.
let us find leisure, with our dying breath, to ask for him penitence and pardon."
"Pardon," echoed the fierce Huron, mistaking in his anger the meaning of her words. "The memory of an Indian is longer than the arm of the palefaces. His mercy shorter than their justice. Say, shall I send the yellow hair to her father, and will you follow Magua to the Great Lakes to carry his water and feed him with corn?"
Cora beckoned him away, with an emotion of disgust she could not control. "Leave me," she said, with a solemnity that for a moment checked the barbarity of the Indian. "You mingle bitterness in my prayers. You stand between me and my God."
The slight impression produced on the savage was, however, soon forgotten, and he continued pointing, with taunting irony, towards Alice.
"Look, the child weeps. She is young to die. Send her to Monroe, to comb his gray hairs and keep life in the heart of the old man."
Cora could not resist the desire to look upon her youthful sister, in whose eyes she met an imploring glance that betrayed the longings of nature.
"What says he, dearest Cora?" asked the trembling voice of Alice. "Did he speak of sending me to our father?"
For many moments the elder sister looked upon the younger, with a countenance that wavered with powerful and contending emotions. At length she spoke, though her tones had lost their rich and calm fullness, in an expression of tenderness that seemed maternal.
"Alice," she said, "the Huron offers us both life. Nay, more than both. He offers to restore Duncan, our invaluable Duncan, as well as you, to our friends, to our father, to our heart-stricken, childless father, if I will bow down this rebellious, stubborn pride of mine and consent."
Her voice became choked, and clasping her hands, she looked upward as if seeking in her agony intelligence from a wisdom that was infinite.
"Say on," cried Alice. "To what, dearest Cora? Oh, that the proffer were made to me, to save you, to cheer our aged father, to restore Duncan, how cheerfully could I die?"
"Die," repeated Cora with a calmer and a firmer voice.
"That were easy.
Perhaps the alternative may not be less so."
"He would have me," she continued, her accents sinking under a deep consciousness of the degradation of the proposal. "Follow him to the wilderness. Go to the habitations of the Hurons. To remain there. In short, to become his wife. Speak then, Alice, child of my affections, sister of my love, and you too, Major Heyward. Aid my weak reason with your counsel. Is life to be purchased by such a sacrifice? Will you, Alice, receive it at my hands at such a price? And you, Duncan, guide me. Control me between you, for I am wholly yours."
"Would I?" echoed the indignant and astonished youth. "Cora, Cora, you jest with our misery. Name not the horrid alternative again. The thought itself is worse than a thousand deaths."
"That such would be your answer, I well knew,"
exclaimed Cora, her cheeks flushing and her dark eyes once more sparkling with the lingering emotions of a woman.
"What says my Alice? For her will I submit without another murmur."
Although both Heyward and Cora listened with painful suspense and the deepest attention, no sounds were heard in reply. It appeared as if the delicate and sensitive form of Alice would shrink into itself as she listened to this proposal. Her arms had fallen lengthwise before her, the fingers moving in slight convulsions. Her head dropped upon her bosom, and her whole person seemed suspended against the tree, looking like some beautiful emblem of the wounded delicacy of her sex, devoid of animation and yet keenly conscious. In a few moments, however, her head began to move slowly, in a sign of deep, unconquerable disapprobation.
"No, no, no. Better that we die as we have lived, together."
"Then die!" shouted Magua,
hurling his tomahawk with violence at the unresisting speaker, and gnashing his teeth with a rage that could no longer be bridled at this sudden exhibition of firmness in the one he believed the weakest of the party. The axe cleaved the air in front of Heyward, and cutting some of the flowing ringlets of Alice, quivered in the tree above her head. The sight maddened Duncan to desperation. Collecting all his energies in one effort, he snapped the twigs which bound him, and rushed upon another savage who was preparing with loud yells and a more deliberate aim to repeat the blow. They encountered,
grappled and fell to the earth together. The naked body of his antagonist afforded Hayward no means of holding his adversary, who glided from his grasp and rose again with one knee on his chest, pressing him down with the weight of a giant. Duncan already saw the knife gleaming in the air when a whistling sound swept past him and was rather accompanied than followed by the sharp crack of a rifle. He felt his breast relieved from the load it had endured. He saw the savage expression of his adversary's countenance change to a look of vacant wildness when the Indian fell dead on the faded leaves by his side.